Thank you. With that, I will call the third case, which is case number A24-0437, Walters versus Minnesota Department of Corrections. I just, before we begin, want to make sure, counsel, that you have it in gallery view so that you're able to see the time clock. I'd just like to make sure you can both see it. And then I would remind you to please mute your microphone when you're not speaking so that we can avoid the background noise. As you both know, you will be given 15 minutes for argument this morning, and appellant, you'll be given 5 minutes for rebuttal. As I've said, you've probably heard my spiel, but please identify yourself before the argument. We make an oral, or we make an audio recording, and so if you can please identify yourself and your client prior to beginning your argument, it would be much appreciated.
Good morning and thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Sarah Jewell on behalf of the appellant, Joseph Walters. He is here remotely as well as our law clerk, Adam Seward, who will just be observing today's waiting anxiously for his bar results. We are all hoping it goes well. I'm sure it will. And so thank you and sorry for any confusion. Mr. Abris is no longer with our firm. He actually joined the state public defender's office at the end of June, much to my sadness, but you know, good for them. They're getting a great person. And so that was hence the substitution here today, but we are ready to proceed. And so our thrust of our argument today is that you know, the situation with my client, Mr. Walters, is that, you know, there were a lot of ongoing and continuing, you know, complaints, concerns that he was raising that were constantly kind of combated by those within the DOC. And, you know, it's not for us to really decide who was right or wrong in that. And that's what I feel was, you know, wrong by Judge Buccicone, who I've appeared before. I think she's a wonderful person and a great judge. But in this situation, I do feel she erred because we have two really major situations, I think, that are not for summary judgment. They're not ripe for summary judgment. One is actual facts in dispute. And then, you know, I mean, that's the standard, right? And then two
is, I understand the trial court in this matter said the only fact in dispute was apparently a statement that was made by Lieutenant Dirks, something to the effect that the DOC has a way of getting back at you. But the decision that was ultimately rendered didn't even factor that in. So what difference would that make if that's a disputed fact?
Well, I guess that's what I would like this court to look at more completely, I guess, and thoroughly is that, you know, in my world, there is, you know, there need to be no facts in dispute for summary judgment to be granted. There should not even be one fact in dispute.
That would be similar to saying it was raining on the day that something happened. And if the rain has no difference, it doesn't become a part of the holding.
Okay.
The question I want to put to you, Ms. Jewell, because you have a burden or a hurdle as far as going forward is res judicata. Apparently you split your claims between state court and federal court. Do you agree that if we would affirm on res judicata that the rest of your complaint just falls away?
No, we do not agree with that. We feel like that was a separate.
How do you distinguish your state complaint then from the matters that were raised in federal court and decided?
Thank you, Your Honor. So I feel like we briefed that very thoroughly, especially in our reply. I would point the court to that. We were able to very clearly articulate and decipher between, you know, which claims and things had arisen at the time that the federal religious discrimination complaint was submitted versus the allegations and complaints at the state court level, some had not arisen in time. And so it's unfair to bar all of those claims going forward when some of them had not occurred. And we were also claiming that there was an ongoing pattern and practice of continued retaliation and discrimination against our client because he kept bringing these different concerns forward and he was definitely treated more harshly.
Can I ask you this, Ms. Jewell? It would help me to ground your argument and respondents in a clear understanding of what do you assert are the protected conduct from which all of the retaliatory and discriminatory response flow? Is it just the complaint back in February of 2021, or is there some other protective conduct that you're arguing?
Thank you. I appreciate that. So it's the original, I mean, these were new policies. If we kind of dial back, it's been a few years now, but these were new policies that were being rolled out. My client's claim was that the N95 mask situation, the way it was being handled at the time, was not in concert with the federal regulations. And actually, Judge Buccicone did speak to that, but she obviously took all the inferences in favor of the moving party and did not take the inferences in favor of the non-moving party, which we think also was an error. And
well,
so he,
regardless of, I mean, I don't disagree that his concerns, they have been very important and valid to raise. I'm trying to get to the question of what are the protected acts? What's the statutorily protected conduct that you point to in this case, just so that we can then evaluate your discrimination claims?
Thank you. So I'm hoping I'm getting to this question. So is my understanding of your question, it's he made he brought forth several concerns over a period of time to different people. And that's why we are saying this is kind of a continuing process. So initially, when these new regulations were rolled out, he brought forth concerns. He brought them forth to the next chain of command. They were not taken well, or they said, we'll work on it, but he didn't feel like it ever got worked on, or things didn't get scheduled. Then retaliation started to ensue. At some point later, then there was continued activity with the Minnesota OSHA claim, as well as regarding the, are we complying with federal regulations on how to fit these masks? He claimed he was having problems with visual acuity. There was a glare coming down from the lights. I haven't been into the facility that Mr. Walters worked in to see, you know, what exactly that looked like, but he claimed that it caused him to have loss of peripheral vision, which I'm sure as a, you know, a person doing security inside a prison is extremely important, because, you know, the smallest thing you may need to be aware of at all times and sort of have your head on a swivel and be able to see that peripheral vision. So, you know, it's multiple things. If you look at the facts section of our brief, as well as the reply, it lays out a numerous times when he's made those concerns known. So it arises from those continued.
But your claim, as I understand it, was a claim for retaliation based on the OSHA complaint and under the Whistleblower Act. So the fact that he may have complained to other people in the DOC, that's not part of a retaliation claim, is it? I mean, that they may have treated him poorly, but that is not, I mean, you're not linking that to the ultimate whistleblower retaliation complaint.
Well, I think it actually does need to be brought into consideration, because it sounded like, you know, again, this fact dispute that Judge Buccicone noted in her footnote, it's footnote number 3 in the court's decision. She says there is a fact dispute between Lieutenant Dirks and my client over, you know, hey, we have ways to deal with this. I think they didn't like him complaining. They didn't like want to hear about it. They didn't, you know, nobody as a supervisor likes to hear, you know, complaints or ongoing issues that haven't been resolved. But at the same time, you know, there is a duty and an obligation for, you know, the employer to take that seriously and to say, hey, let's sit down and see what the issue is here and work through that. And instead of doing that, our client just continually got retaliated against to the point that he lost, you know, he had discipline on his record. He lost the right to serve on the Rivers mentorship board or task force. He lost the right to
just so I'm clear, Ms. Jewell. Sure. So are you then, at least as far as the claim origination, the OSHA report way back in February 2021, that's the catalyst for all of the discrimination and retaliation that is then.
I don't think that's how we argued it. I think we argued that was one of the
forward
issues.
Your client.
I think it was one of the catalysts or issues, but it went even
that's
beyond
the
that.
Case. Why could not all of those issues have been resolved through the federal litigation? I mean, if they were all apparent and there, why could they not have been addressed? He had an opportunity to address that, didn't he?
That was a religious discrimination claim. And I mean, I guess the federal courts can take supplemental jurisdiction over that, but we don't think that that bars or bans, you know, a person bringing state claims into state court.
Okay, so that helps me then. So that's why you made the decision then to lodge a certain action in federal court and the other actions in district court, Minnesota?
Correct. Yeah. And especially when I think the timing piece is really important. You know, the religious discrimination also did not include the same, you know, parties that are in issue in this case. It was a different person who my client alleged, you know, denied his request for days off for religious holidays and that type of thing. So, you know, it's not.
Ms. Jewell, yes. As I understand that federal action, the federal action pointed back to the February of 2021 complaint to OSHA as the basis for the religious discrimination. Or as the reason behind it?
I'm sorry.
No, that's my understanding of the allegations of that federal complaint. Am I right about that?
I think it was mentioned in there, and I think that, you know, I think it was viewed as, again, you know, kind of a conglomeration of different continuing acts. It was a kind of a continuing process where my client was raising concerns, and instead of him feeling like that they were being sort of validly addressed, he started getting treated differently and more harshly in a more negative way. He started having repercussions occur out of this. So that's the, you know, sounds in the retaliation piece of it. As far as the, you know, the parties, it's not the same parties. So we, you know, in our reply, which I'm trying to find here, but the court has it, you know, in its
different
files.
Parties, do you mean different employees for the Department of Corrections? Or
yes,
do
correct.
You mean, okay.
Right. Yeah, I apologize for the misunderstanding there. But right. The thing I also want to point out is that there are no declarations or affidavits from any of the therapists in the Rivers program. That's another fact issue and dispute in this matter. The DOC makes a big deal about how, you know, these therapists were complaining that my client was requiring inmates to use common courtesy terms such as please or thank you, and that had been something, you know, done for the past 5 years or more. All of a sudden, the DOC is saying, no, that wasn't our protocol, that wasn't our policy, and that the Rivers folks, which is hearsay, you know, we can't prove the truth of the matter asserted in regard to those Rivers staff members' alleged complaints. I don't see any affidavits proving that up at all. It's all through the DOC. Employees and staff saying that they're hearing this from them, whereas my client in his affidavit and declarations is saying, hey, you know, I was being complimented by the Rivers therapist because they felt it was healthy and that it was a good way for, you know, a learning and growth opportunity and to just reinforce how to behave within the community and achieving some of the goals that they were looking for. So, but instead, you know, the district court seems to have construed that against my client and, you know, used it against him. And so that's another factual inference. We don't have any direct evidence on that in the summary judgment motion. There are no statements from any of the Rivers therapists that, you know, would affirm that one way or the other. So those are the things we're trying to get to here is, you know, it's very easy for courts to dismiss matters like this on summary judgment and kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater. But, you know, what really needs to happen is we need a trial. We need to look at the credibility of witnesses. Who's right on that? We don't know. And it's premature at summary judgment stage to throw the entire matter out until we really know what is the truth of that. What is that, you know, how do we resolve that fact dispute? In addition to the other fact disputes that we've raised as well, where, you know, Mr. Walters claims that, you know, there was this retaliatory statement, but then the DOC, Lieutenant Dirks is denying that. You know, Judge Buccicone, again, in footnote 3, admits that that is a factual dispute that is not resolved, and she cannot resolve that at the summary judgment stage. So we do believe that that is, you know, a very plain and simple, you know, error by the court that should not have been determined on summary judgment, because we can't just assume that that person is telling the truth and the other one isn't telling the truth. We need to find that at the trier of fact level, which is the, you know, the court or the, excuse me, the jury.
What's the strongest or what competent evidence was presented on summary judgment to support a determination that the adverse employment conduct or adverse employment decisions were pretext for retaliation based on the Whistleblower Act and for filing the OSHA claim?
If I understand your question correctly, Justice Bjorkman, it's the fact that my client got discipline put on his record, which is, you know, in any profession, when you've got discipline on your record, you know, obviously that's never a good thing for promotions, for wage increases, limiting him
I'm not asking about whether your client made a prima facie showing.
Sure.
I'm talking about getting to the pretext, the third part of the McDonnell Douglas analysis. And I'm wondering, because as I understand, the DOC responded with, well, yeah, the reason we did this is we had all these complaints from inmates. And the reason we did, I mean, so yes, it's the he said, she said. What is the strongest, most compelling, competent evidence that everything DOC presented was simply a pretext for retaliation and discrimination?
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the clarification. So I think it really goes to my client stating, like, I've been here for many years. These are the protocols that were in place during this entire time. I was never reprimanded for doing this in the past. I was never, ever disciplined. I never had anything written down in my file that said it was a wrong thing to require someone to say common courtesies such as thank you or please. That was never something that was imposed against him in the past until after he had made, you know, these concerns known and had raised his voice on these N95 concerns, the Minnesota OSHA claim, and all those things. This all flowed after that. I would like to use the very small time I have left just to point out, since the summary judgment decision was issued back in April, back earlier this winter, we have now a new case that was issued in April by the United States Supreme Court, the Muldrow versus City of St. Louis. I'm sure the court has, you know, heard a lot about that. And I just want to point out to that as well, and this more goes to, you know, whether the appellant suffered, you know, this kind of adverse action, whether even though his pay was not decreased, but just to further support the legal portion of our claim that, you know, him having this discipline on his record, being barred from volunteer activities and serving on the Rivers Mentor Program is further supported by that U.S. Supreme Court case. And I will rest. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondents.
Good morning, Your Honors. Nick Platson on behalf of the Department of Corrections, and may it please the court. I want to touch on 3 points today. First, the res judicata question should be affirmed. Second, this case fails on the merits. And third, a number of the arguments that are presented on appeal have been waived or forfeited. Want to just call back to one comment in the opening argument here was that there were no affidavits from the Rivers Treatment Program individuals. At exhibit or index 62, you have the Travis Schlangen's deposition. He was the acting director of the Rivers program at the time. So if there's a concern about that, the information is there. As to the-
in terms of whether this involved the same set of factual circumstances, I think part of, as I understand appellant's argument, that they're raising actions that occurred after the complaint had been filed in federal court. Why the fact that, you know, there's sort of some ongoing or furthering conduct, why isn't that sufficient to say that this is a different set of factual circumstances than those that occurred in the federal case?
So just to be clear, we only argued that res judicata should apply up to the date of the federal complaint. And so that would take care of the oral reprimand from June of 2021 and the written reprimand of February 2022. And all of those leave requests that he challenged in the federal complaint occur between June of 2021 and February of 2022. And that's part of our argument why this is all the same piece. Then there's the what we call the post-complaint.
So you would agree with appellant that res judicata did not preclude all of their claims?
Well, it's nuanced because they didn't include the other claims that they raised after the state court claim was filed. So the state court complaint is filed on August 18th of 2022, or 2023, 2022. And then in the fall of 2022, he experiences more a written reprimand, a 3-day suspension, and a 5-day suspension. So we don't contest that res judicata applies to those because they couldn't. Res judicata only applies up to that date. We do contend that they weren't properly raised. They weren't identified to us until the day before the close of discovery in his deposition. Plaintiff did not identify them in response to written discovery, never made an effort to amend the complaint to add them. So we believe they're waived. However, we even think that on the merits, if they're included, they fail as a matter of law. Mr. Walters himself indicated that his complaint was not the reason for those disciplines, that His testimony was that everybody was required to go through it. Everybody knew that they would be disciplined if they didn't go through it. He refused to go through it. And it didn't matter that he had complained previously to OSHA about them. And so I think just delineating between which complaints those are, race judicata does not apply to those claims. I would agree with that. So essentially, race judicata should take care of what we think is properly pled in the complaint. There was no continuing violation either alleged. If you look at counts 1 and 2 of the complaint, there's no indication that this was ongoing. There's no facts alleged, no notice that this was a continuing practice either. And we know that the plaintiff or the plaintiff's attorney knew how to allege that because in count 3, which is no longer a part of this case, it's a data practices claim that we've resolved in the midst of discovery. They allege a continuing violation in count 3 about the data practices claim. So we have to construe their complaint for what it is and what they chose to allege and not allege. And so I think the absence of a continuing violation in the first two counts, where as it's included in the third, suggests they knew how to plead it, whether to plead it, and what to do with it. Now, secondly, just moving on to the prima facie case, I don't think we have protected activity under the Whistleblower Act. And an employee does not have to be correct that a law is being violated, but there has to be a law that requires the action they're complaining about. And here is where I think we get where complainant's claim fails. Now, in the Kratzer versus Welsh Companies case, the Supreme Court case from 2009, they were dealing with a statute and a regulation that applied to brokers in certain types of financial transactions and their disclosure requirements, what they had to disclose when they represented both sides in a deal. The plaintiff in that case indicated that, you know, there was a certain failure to disclose certain pieces of information that they thought was insufficient. And when the court looked at the regulation in question, it said that, you know, there has to be some type of disclosure, but not to the type that the plaintiff prefers or the amount of disclosure that they wanted. And so there was no protected activity under the Whistleblower Act. Now, in this case, Mr. Walters indicates that his complaint is that DOC did not comply with the OSHA fit testing and medical evaluation and medical screening requirements. Now, when we look a little bit further at what exactly his claim is, if we look at Index 86, Exhibit H, he describes his complaint as that when he went to go get fit tested, he was not given a medical evaluation by a licensed physician or other licensed healthcare professional. He was not given an OSHA compliant questionnaire prior to the requirement of fit testing. Now, what we know, and it is undisputed, is that Mr. Walters did have medical evaluations, did do medical questionnaires at previous times in his employment with the DOC. But the regulation in question does not require employers of existing employees to continue to medically evaluate and subject people to medical questionnaires every time they get fit tested. Once a person has been determined fit, they
so have... is this an issue that's a fact?
I'm sorry, you broke up, Your Honor.
We'll just in dispute then, yeah. Because your what was said about DOC coming back on you identified as a fact dispute, precluding summary judgment.
No, it's not. His claim, and that's what his complaint was, is not in dispute. I believe that he made that complaint, and we're not disputing that it was made or not. I'm simply saying that it is not, as a matter of law, protected activity, because the law doesn't require what he was complaining of. The regulation in question does not require a medical evaluation and a medical questionnaire every time, unless there's three criteria met. Well, which DOC uses a screening form to identify just a yes or no question, whether or not they should go back for further evaluation. Existing employees don't have to be reevaluated every year. So unless there's like a change to medical circumstances or something like that of the employee, then they would require another one.
Mr. Platson, assuming we disagree with you and that we conclude that this complaint, even though it might not have been well-founded, was protected activity, why doesn't Lieutenant Dirkus's statement to the appellant back in March of 2021 about, you know, they have a way of getting back getting you back if you go against them. Why doesn't that provide evidence that the department stated reasons for imposing discipline beginning, I guess, in 2022, or well, no, June of 2021, and then subsequently is a pretext for retaliation?
And before you answer, Mr. Platson, I went back and looked at the judge's order. The judge did take that as a truthful statement for the purpose of her evaluation. Just wanted to correct that because I think I said it was just.
Okay. Yeah. And we didn't dispute it. So, yeah. Yeah. So as to Lieutenant Dirks' statement, which is disputed, there's a couple of things that we can do with that statement. One, it doesn't affect the oral reprimand in 2021. And that the reason for that is this. The oral reprimand follows 4 months after the protected activity. That's a time period that's too long to establish causation with the Whistleblower Act. Also, if we look at the undisputed facts of what happens after that statement's alleged to have been made, it's also undisputed that Lieutenant Dirkus never told anyone else that Mr. Walters disclosed that he was the source of the protected activity. He didn't tell anyone else. That's undisputed. And what Mr. Walters says happened after he told him this information is that he shrugged his shoulders and walked away. Lieutenant Dirkus did not care. A lot of employees did not like wearing PPE. It was not uncommon. He testifies to that in his declaration as well. Now, we don't get to the alleged adverse action until the end of June 2021. And a lot happens in between that to break up any inference of causation beyond just temporal proximity or that comment. We have this question of the please and thank you requirements. Now, Lieutenant Dirkus doesn't take it upon himself after hearing that to go out and initiate discipline or aggressively go after Mr. Walters. What he does is once he hears that there's complaints originating from somewhere else about his conduct, about Mr. Walters' conduct, he goes to Mr. Walters 4 or 5 times informally trying to get him to change his behavior. It doesn't work. He then goes to the next supervisor up, pulls them in. Again, informal conversation, try to get the behavior changed. The next supervisor up, this is not evidence of retaliatory animus. This is evidence of simple performance management. And even once we get to the disciplinary action, at the end of June 2021, it's an oral reprimand, which does not go into the personnel file. It is not grievable. It does not do really anything other to materially affect the employment prospects of the employee.
Is it part of progressive discipline, though?
It is. And I would say that it would be adverse actions, and we are alleged it's not. And the reason it's not here is because we never see it again. It's never used for subsequent or a second discipline. They don't go up the scale from the oral reprimand. When he's disciplined in February of 2022, he gets a written reprimand, which is the second lowest. But this isn't based on anything relating to the June 2021 written reprimand. It's not saying, also, you were reprimanded at this level before, so now we're going to level 2. That's not what the evidence shows. And in fact, all of the decision makers in the second reprimand, the written reprimand, were different. Lieutenant Durkee is out of the picture. He's not Mr. Walters' supervisor by July of 2021. And so none of those individuals involved had any awareness of Mr. Walters' protected activity. And it was an entirely separate incident for that discipline. Now, a contrast, I think, to show kind of what the difference would be is that in the fall of 2022, in these sort of what we call the post-complaint claims, where Mr. Walters alleges he was given a written reprimand, 3 days of discipline, 5 days of suspension. There you can see the written reprimand, while I think on its face, on its own, would not necessarily be an adverse action, but is then used to substantiate the 3-day suspension, which is used to substantiate the 5-day suspension. So these other written and oral reprimands don't end up mattering. Moreover, he did not intend to seek any sort of promotion or so any sort of allegations by him that he was denied the opportunity then because he had these written disciplines to participate in the mentor program or seek promotions. He testified that he had no intent to ever do so. So it's not as if he was denied the benefit of employment if he never intended to exercise the benefit. It's illusory. With that, if there's any other particular questions that stand out for the bench, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a few points in response to Mr. Platson's argument. First off the bat, defense's claim, or excuse me, their pleading of an affirmative defense of res judicata was not pled timely in this matter. It was not pled in their initial answer as an affirmative defense. And, you know, in our brief and our reply, we speak to this, that if they do not do that or even amend, you know, the answer at a later time, if say they wanted to add that affirmative defense back in into their pleading, they failed to do so. And according to the case law we've cited, that means that respondents have waived that. And so actually that bars their entire res judicata claim. And so the court cannot impose that against the plaintiff because they did not allege it timely and did not amend the answer to go ahead and allege that at any point. Also, speaking to the whistleblower claim, if I heard it correctly, Mr. Platson stated that, or made the argument, I should say, that my client was incorrect in some of his, you know, complaints regarding Minnesota OSHA, or that he didn't really, you know, validly understand the regulatory scheme and make an accurate, for lack of a better word, like an accurate complaint. But that is not at all what Minnesota Whistleblower Act requires. It simply requires a good faith based, basically allegation that they think or believe something has been violated, whether it's a, you know, a statute, a code of regulations, some regulatory agency's rules making. My client doesn't have to be correct. He's not a lawyer. He's not trained in the law. That is not his career in terms of being a, you know, juris doctor. And that is certainly not what the Whistleblower Act requires. And so I just wanted to point that out, that it seemed to be going that route. And I wanted to make sure that we point out that distinction. Also, one last point on the declaration of Travis Schlangen, which I was mentioning earlier, we didn't have anything in the record from an actual Rivers therapist. And if we look closely, I have that in front of me right now. Paragraph 3 of the declaration of Travis Schlangen states that the Rivers program in 2021 did not have a permanent supervisor from January to April. I know there were probably a lot of us that were short-staffed, but during that time, Mr. Schlangen, provided backup coverage, which included splitting duties as a backup supervisor with PSD Lovas in lieu of the vacant position. And Mr. Schlangen, in his declaration, states that he had worked at different times with the Rivers program, but pointing the court to page 2 of Mr. Schlangen's declaration, paragraph 7, he again makes a hearsay statement. He states therapy staff in the Rivers program expressed frustration with my client's behavior, and then goes into some details about that. But again, we don't have the direct evidence or testimony from the therapists themselves. So this again is a factual dispute, and also goes to credibility of the witnesses, which again precludes and prevents summary judgment at this stage. Unless there are any other questions, I will rest. Thank you.
I have just one question. That is, how do you respond to the state's argument that the gap in time between the February 2021 Protected Act and the first act of retaliation, which I understand was 4 months later, is there any case law that would say that despite that gap, there is a sufficient causal connection between the complaint to OSHA and the adverse employment action?
Thank you very much for that question. I don't have a case to cite on point exactly to that, other than what we've stated, that this was a continuing action. And that did remind me of another point I wanted to make very briefly, that Mr. Platson mentioned that there was a different supervisor who implemented the additional discipline of the 3-day and the 5-day suspension. But that completely ignores the fact that supervisors are able to see the supervisor file. So, you know, in employment law, we have sort of the employee file, which may not contain all the discipline, but there's typically a more kind of secret or confidential file, which is the supervisor notes and past disciplines. So, you know, to me, it's very obvious or should be that any other supervisor who steps into that role is going to be able to open up Mr. Walter's, you know, discipline portion of his file and clearly see that there was, you know, prior discipline. And, you know, whether it was 2 months prior or 4 months prior, that still does not bar Mr. Walter's claims. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel in this matter. This case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in the time prescribed by statute.